I truly feel that my purpose is expressing my story, sharing my story through movement, through art. And then through being so passionate about that, it gives the people around me permission to also explore what their passion is, you know, to also do what they love to do and maybe discover what that is for them.
We would like to acknowledge that we are on stolen Yuggera and Turrbal lands, and as settlers of colour, we reflect upon the damaging legacy of colonisation. Always was, always will be.
My name is Nadia Infusion, and I've dedicated over 15 years of my life to the entertainment industry, specifically being a movement artist, a dance instructor, a choreographer, and more recently getting into the events curation field and producing more events for the community, and a budding DJ.
Yeah, right. When do you remember when the kind of like, was there such thing as a first spark for dance for you? I guess many of us will have some involvement with dance as kids, and perhaps all of us do, but in some way. But was there a time where it was like, no, this is my thing?
Ooh, okay. So there's two chapters of that moment.
Yeah.
The this is my thing moment happened, I'd say just before I went into my teen years. But the very first time that I took a dance lesson or got into dance or discovered dance, started exploring that, was actually when mom, we were living in Melbourne, mom put me into ballet school. I was like, oh, maybe you'd like to do this.
Yeah.
And I did not enjoy ballet at all. My mom reminds me to this day, like how I would stay in the corner and sulk and be like, I don't want to dance. I don't want to. And the whole class would always be jetting around the room, and I'll just be sitting there in the corner sulking. Anyway, fast forward, moved to Malaysia. And then my dad suggested, or even my mom really for that matter, actually suggested that I explore traditional Malay folk dance as well as Balinese dance.
Right.
I guess to stay connected with the roots and the tradition and culture and stuff like that. But to answer your question really specifically as to when I felt like this is my thing is really when I started to express myself in the safety of my bedroom.
Yeah.
As a way of releasing a lot of the daily frustrations, if I say it very loosely, that I was dealing with as a child growing up in Malaysia, as a mixed child to be exact.
Right.
Yeah. So it was probably that time that I really, really connected with dance on a much deeper level, where I found solace, peace, and this overwhelming sense of joy. Like I kind of created my own little world of like, what a utopia would feel like and how I would feel like in this utopia world through just movement.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So it's like this fantasy land.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hmm.
And what outside of your bedroom were you supported by a dance community or going to dance classes, or like how in solitude was that?
Very. I was not supported by no dance community or taking any dance classes. It was definitely a very personal practice.
Yeah.
Because it was very much a way to, like I was saying, release. It was a cathartic thing that I did, meditational almost, you know, not even almost. I would say that it was very meditational. And it was therapy for the, using that word very loosely, of course. And it was my healer at the time. So that's why it was really personal. It just wasn't like it was a sacred space.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't do it in a performative manner. It wasn't for people to see. It was really for me to kind of like close the doors, be in this safe space, put the music on really loud that I can't hear any of the other noise that was in my head and even just outside my physical surroundings, get lost in the music for hours, and then come out of this being like, oh, God, I feel lighter now and I can take on the world again. You know, what that meant as a young person, of course, or as little Nadia. Yeah.
Right. And so like the ballet and like the structured group classes wasn't working for you. What was it about that sort of bedroom space, and what was different about that?
So the bedroom space was at a different chapter of my life where ballet was no longer present. Like, okay. That was something that we tried for, I don't even know how long. I think it was a very short-lived period.
Yeah.
And then the traditional Balinese and folk dance was, traditional Balinese and Malay folk dance was, I suppose it was sort of overlapping with that whole bedroom period.
Yeah.
But I would say that the self-expression, improvisation in my room and everything kind of started to take a primary focus or a bigger focus when I started to sort of also leave the traditional dance classes world. So it really was a period where I was no longer taking dance classes, actually. Yeah.
Right. Mm. Okay. And so when we're born somewhere and we move and we grow up somewhere and we've got origins from another place, they often call us like third culture kids, right?
Mm.
What did that feel like to you as a kid growing up in Malaysia?
He's asking a loaded question. look, I'm South African Malaysian, yeah. Right? And so I grew up in a South African Malaysian household. Being born in Melbourne or Narm, and relocated or moved to Malaysia when I was 6 years old, right? Yeah. And it was, if I were to like look back at that or try to put myself back in that time, it was really jarring and really confusing because I was just like, oh, I'm this, you know, you're young, you're naive to the world and you really just feel like you're obviously discovering yourself and everything around you and you're just feeling like, okay, I'm just this human being, like all of these other parameters don't really figure in your life at the time. You don't understand those things, right? But I had to understand it really quickly because of the bullying and the discrimination and the racism that I experienced
right.
From a very young age.
Mm.
And I started to understand really quickly that I was different, you know, and I looked different, I spoke different, my household looked different, my accent was different, obviously didn't speak the main language or one of the main languages in Malaysia, and that's Bahasa, but as we all need to survive, you know, and then of course being young and being able to pick things up really quickly with your brain being a sponge, I picked up Bahasa really quick.
Right.
Especially being in a public system school too, where
yeah.
the language spoken there was Bahasa. So
yeah.
it was kind of like, well, I can't really be going around trying to make friends speaking English when they don't really speak English.
Right.
So had to
survival
really,
instinct stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And do you think that, like, so people knew you as the other, but did they know you?
No, definitely it was the other. There was two experiences. There was the one experience where it was like, oh, I don't really want to be friends with her because she's like the weird one, the different one. And then it would switch up to like, oh, she's the different one. So because she's the different one, she's cool.
Oh.
Let's go hang out with her.
It would go in waves like that?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. And it was very much sort of, oh, I found some friends. Oh, no, they're not my friends. Oh, I found some, oh, no, they're not my friends. So that was, yeah, the constant experience that remained, how would I say? No, it was the ongoing experience that sort of like overshadowed my mainly primary school life.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And what was it that brought your family and your life to Malaysia from now?
My dad being Malay, first of all, and being Malaysian.
Mm.
And being an artist. So he's a fine artist. And my parents met in Melbourne. He was studying at the Victorian College of the Arts and trying to establish himself as an artist and had a dream to have a gallery and established a gallery in Melbourne. But at the time, from the stories that my parents told me during that time, galleries and fine art wasn't something that was I suppose truly valued where it was financially sustainable,
right?
So he felt like after a period of time of, I guess, struggling and trying to build that in Melbourne, he was like, hey, I would like to go back to Malaysia and actually do it in my own home country, my homelands, and see how that would work. And it really worked out well for him.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So you not only had a creative career modeled by a parent, but you had both the experience of that not working out so well in one place and then finding some success in that.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Is do you think that sort of helped plant a seed in you that, that maybe that's something you can do?
I'm very grateful for growing up with a father that was super creative. And I would say that in the it was 2 years ago that I had a really great healing moment of actually forgiving my dad, because we don't really have much of a relationship, but I got to a point, and that's a whole other story that we'll maybe or maybe not unpack, but anyway.
Yeah.
I got to a point 2 years ago where I forgave him, and I managed to actually see past all the crap, to put it in more simplest terms, traumatic experiences growing up in that family, and felt like I'm actually super grateful for what was shown to me at the time and growing up. So the double-edged sword was that, like, being so passionate about his art and so much married to his practice.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a very absent dad.
Okay.
You know?
Right.
And obviously that affected me and my brother growing up, you know. I was always like, oh, like, wow, like, we really don't have a relationship. And for many, many years, that plus other reasons, I resented him, you know. But now that I'm a fully established full-time artist and just seeing the way I operate in my life, I go, wow, I am in some ways like pretty much repeating what I saw in my childhood, being so passionate and so hardworking and so dedicated and so determined.
Okay.
So these are positive things that came out of something for many, many years I saw as a negative.
Okay.
Meaning like the fact that he wasn't present.
Right.
But now that I'm older, I'm able to go like, wait, like, okay, he wasn't able to be the, you know, number one star dad in this way.
Yeah.
But there's definitely things that I learned from that as an example. And that is like probably the reason why I'm still in this industry, even though it's so cutthroat and so unforgiving most of the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that resilience was like baked in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, yep, yep.
And when did dance go beyond the bedroom for you? I mean, you did talk about engaging with traditional dance in Malaysia, but...
I would say it was as I continued the practice by myself, for myself in my teenage years, I started to really feel like, you know, I really love this thing called dance. Like, how could I potentially pursue this further professionally, take it more seriously?
Yeah.
And for a very long time, I was quite arrogant about the natural talent that I had. No, for real. Looking back at that time, I remember being like, you know, like so naive. I was thinking, oh, I'm just going to like dance on the street somewhere. And this film crew, recruiter or casting person, whatever, would see this talent and go like, hey, we're going to cast you and you're going to be this one big famous dancer. For a long time, I had this dream, you know, like that's what I thought how it was going to happen for me, you know?
And I think like a lot of us get sold on that and like kind of have those dreams.
Yeah.
When we're younger, especially, right?
Yeah. So for a very long time, I kind of held on to that really unrealistic. I mean, I feel like it does happen. It does happen to some people, but I feel like in a grander scheme of things, I don't think it happens to like, if it was 10 people trying to do that, I feel like it would happen to like one person out of those 10 people. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
So it was when I graduated high school that I flipped a switch and I said, okay, it's 6 months before I go to uni or go to college and I'm trying to work my way to getting back to Australia. What am I going to do in this six, seven month period? And my mom had a friend from South Africa. She was the first colored ballerina to get into her school back in the day in South Africa. And that's another conversation again.
Yeah, yeah.
But she was running a dance studio in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And I basically said, okay, I'd like to spend the next 6 to 7 months actually going and doing a full-time dance course. So told mom that and got myself enrolled. And for 7 months, I was deep in doing my first full-time dance certification. So I did a bit of ballet, contemporary, jazz, Bollywood, and hip-hop. Well, hip-hop, now of course I understand things a little bit better compared to then.
Right.
And multiple other styles, yeah.
And then was that just prior to heading into secondary education?
No, that was when I had just graduated secondary school.
Yeah.
So I was 17
Sorry,
years
old. Tertiary education. Was it just prior to going into like a uni?
Yeah. So I was 17 years old. Yeah. And that was when I really went like, hey, wait, I want to approach dance professionally here. Mm. So let's give it a shot. Let's humble ourselves and let's not think like, you know, we're going to get picked up and discovered like that and actually take on some professional proper dance training in the dance styles that would make it onto TV, music videos and films. So traditional dance was there for the first 3 years of my childhood of like from between 7 to 9.
Yeah.
And then there was that big hiatus of just me exploring my own movement in my teen years.
Okay.
And then going like, wait, I actually think that it's time for me to take some proper dance classes. Yeah.
What did that experience leave with you? What was the impression on you from that 7 months?
It's very simple. It was just that I felt like, wow, I feel so good, happy, and at peace dancing. And what better way to live the rest of my life to just do that?
Wow.
It sounds so simplistic, but that's really what I wanted.
Okay.
And what I still want, because it is still the thing that brings me just so much peace. And, you know, fast forward, because I was 17 then and I'm 36 now, right? Fast forward all those years. I've definitely, dance has been, I mean, even before 17, like when I started dancing in my room and that was the cathartic practice, right? Mm. From that time till now, it still is such a powerful healer for me.
Right.
And I feel like knowing that power and throughout that journey of like doing it first for myself and finding the healing that it brought me, over the years, it evolved into, wow, dance is so powerful.
Mm.
And how can I now share that power of movement and dance and have other people experience the medicine that it is? Yeah.
And so what was the next steps in your kind of dance student life?
So I studied really hard at in high school, got really good grades. And I did that because I had one goal. I didn't want to continue living in Malaysia. You know, like I mentioned earlier, childhood was really hard and it never got easier.
Hmm.
And I realized that nothing's going to change, like, as in I'm never going to really fully belong or feel like I fully belong, no matter how many traditional clothes I wear, how many Eid Mubaraks or Hari Rayas we celebrate, how much I speak the language, how much I eat the local food. I mean, then again, there was also that where I kind of really wanted to run away from everything that remotely made me feel like I needed to be Malay, because I was like, why should I try to be that when I am that by blood, but y'all don't see me that way. You don't see me that way. You don't accept me that way. Mm. So why should I even try? And then I started kind of, I suppose, having this self-hate thing, you know, where I was like, oh, I just want to be everything that I see on TV. And everything that I saw on TV was like I think like a lot of Southeast Asian countries and even African, we were taught to hate ourselves, like as in, you know, the color of our skin, no matter what shade, you know. And so what was praised in Malaysia too was Caucasians, you know. And it's, so it's like everyone aspired to, especially when it came to women, generally speaking, aspired to, like, if you married or was in a relationship with quote unquote a white man, you're like up top there. It's like your status is suddenly like
up
the top.
Yeah, it's a life upgrade.
Yeah, it's a life upgrade, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of got a bit lost in that, wanting to say basically, if I bring it back to what we were saying just now. I struggled growing up And for a very long time, I kept on asking my parents to go back to Australia because my fondest memories, even though they were naive and they were very simple because I only spent 6 years growing up in Melbourne,
yeah.
they were the memories that were good. And they were the memories that kept me going and made me go like, okay, there is a better life out there for me if I were to go back to Australia, you know? And so I studied really hard at school because obviously my parents, specifically speaking, my dad didn't want to send me to boarding school because I was 15 years old. I remember being like a mess and being like, just send me back to Australia. I don't want to be here anymore. Like, you know, I'm just miserable. And life was just, it was lifing. As we say these days, life was lifing, to put it in the most like lighthearted way. And anyway, I was like, all right, cool. Like, allow me to go to boarding school in Australia because you think I'm too young and all the other reasons behind it. So I decided to study really hard. I got really good grades and I applied to the University of Queensland and was given a scholarship to study a Bachelor of Science in Marine Biology and Ecology.
Right, right.
And that was basically my ticket out. I went to my dad and I was like, hey, look, studied really hard. I got a scholarship. All I need now is a flight to leave. So get my ticket and I'm gonna go now, you know? And so going back to the question about dance now, that's where I was like, all right, I've got the master plan. I'm gonna go to university. I'm gonna do this full-time degree in marine biology and ecology. And at the same time, the other part of my life is going to be dedicated to doing like a full-time dance course. And of course, at that age, not recognizing there's only 24 hours in a day, I was like, wait, full-time university and full-time dance? In what world does that even happen?
Yeah.
So I quickly realized that is not.
You started the two.
Started the two, what do you mean?
Did you start doing those both full-time?
Well, that's what I wanted, okay. But I realized that wasn't possible.
Okay.
Right? So, and the reason why I decided to study at university and study what I decided to study was because I've always been interested in nature and the environment. But also, actually, the deeper reason, too, alongside that is the fact that my very first teacher, the one that I was being trained under for that 7 months prior to moving to Australia, she was actually quite unfortunately, a mentally and an emotionally abusive teacher, you know. She basically said that I would never make it as a dancer. I'm too old. I've only started dance at 17 years old. So how is that even going to happen? You can't pick up choreography fast enough. You know, so during training classes and everything, it'll always be like this attack. Like I remember we'd do classes, exercises across the room. And lo and behold, I definitely had those moments of trying to leap and doing a jeté across the room, right arm, right leg, left arm, left leg. I didn't have the coordination for some reason in classes, but put on a song and I would have all the coordination in the world and just dance to the beat and express. And,
all right.
You know? So in a structured class environment, I really struggled in those 7 months that I was training because I suppose I was now being told what to do, whereas I've always been letting the music tell me what to do, right? And now it's like I'm listening to the music. The music is telling me to do this thing, but the teacher's telling me to do this other thing that felt super unnatural to me and super structured and rigid.
Right. Yeah.
So for a very long time, I was kind of like fighting against that, you know, and that's why, you know, she said what she said. And I think that trauma I carried through with me, and also it really, really knocked my confidence and my self-esteem in feeling like I could actually pursue dance full time. So going to university was really that sort of like fallback plan of like, okay, let me do my degree and at the same time study dance so that, you know, maybe if the dance takes off, I've kind of proved her wrong, you know, and it's actually works out for me. But if it doesn't work out for me, at least I have that fallback plan and that safety net of like having a piece of paper and a degree in something that I actually enjoy doing. Yeah. So coming back to the original question now about like, did I actually manage to successfully do the full-time dance or part-time dance and part-time study? Or to be quite exact, full-time study and part-time dance, because that's actually what I was looking at.
Right.
And that just like time-wise was just not physically possible because full-time study would start at what, 9 o'clock in the morning sometimes and finish at like 6, 7 and then classes. So what I did then find was discovering Mad Dance House.
Right.
And during my university years, and I believe that was in 2000 and because I came to Brisbane in 2005.
Okay.
So it was in 2007 I discovered Mad Dance House.
Was that kind of relatively early days for Mad Dance House as well?
Yes, yes, yes.
There you go.
They were running their classes out of the old Metro Arts building.
Oh, right.
I think on Edward Street, if I'm not mistaken. But I remember where it is. I just don't remember the name.
Okay.
But it's, smack bang in the middle of Brisbane City.
Right.
It was like 3 floors up.
Mm.
I remember a teacher by the name of Jules. She now does hair.
Huh.
And she was teaching the hip hop class. And here I am walking in with my street jazz sneakers and my bell bottom pants and thinking, yes, I'm about to do my hip hop. This is the hip hop wear. Yo, I was ready. I was like, all right, cool, let's go. It's Mad Dance House. I discovered a dance studio. So I felt like doing university during the day and taking classes at night at Mad Dance House was the way to still feed that passion and that desire that was still so burning, strong within me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And was that a period like, so I'm imagining sort of like casual drop-in classes, like was it beyond hip hop that you were going to? Was it multiple styles that you were checking out?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. At the time, I think the timetable was a bit limited because of the fact that the space, she only had that one room from memory. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was that one room. So the timetable was limited. But when Mad Dance started expanding and then moved to Elizabeth Street, then there was like 3 to 4 studios. Timetable blew up and expanded to like multiple styles from jazz to contemporary to ballet, hip hop. I think she had multiple other street styles, breaking and everything like that. Yeah, so I was kind of immersing myself in all the styles because I guess at the time I was still discovering what I liked. But then more importantly, I just loved it all, you know?
Right. Yeah. So this sort of smorgasbord, this like 31 flavors of dance assortment, beyond loving it all, were you also finding like, it's like, hey, that one really speaks to me and maybe that one really speaks to me?
It was in 2008, a teacher by the name of Amelia Lynch, now Amelia Butler, she came to introduce what I do now, dance hall.
Right.
But at the time, it was on the timetable titled as Hip Hop in Brackets Dance Hall. And I was like, what's that? All right, I'm going to try it out.
Okay.
Tried it out. First class, Sean Paul Temperature was bumping on the speakers.
Right.
And I was like, all right, what? And then, I can't remember what the name of that animation is now, but there's a scene in the animation where the alien starts like, you know, flailing its limbs everywhere and it starts going like, oh my God, what's happening to my body? I can't control this. And then it starts dancing and busting out into a dance.
That's in the video clip, is it?
No, no, no. This is an animation that I'm relating to how
okay.
I felt inside me.
Oh, right, right, right. Okay.
You know, when I heard this song, I was like, whoa, like I just felt these cells come alive like it never had before. My spirit just light up and I was just like, whoa, like I am really called to just dance to this music. I don't understand what the hell he was saying in that song at the time. But all I knew was that the rhythm, or as we say, the rhythm.
Yeah.
And the melodies and the intonation and the flow of how he's singing and all of that, the bass line and all of it was just so like, it was hypnotizing. I just, just going back to that day and just talking about it, I just feel like it was yesterday, like how it just, And that was the beginning of me going, wait, yes, I love dance and I love movement and I always will, but there is this particular style that lights me up in a whole other way that the other styles don't. And there was also this undertone of an energy that came from dance hall that I really felt like I connected with, that felt really familiar in, I say these days, or in the last however many years that I've been on this journey, that it felt kind of familiar, ancestral. And it also felt that it came from, while it made us dance and move and feel this sense of like joy and expression in moving our bodies to this music, there was also this sort of like undertone of like, yo, we're really trying to express ourselves to let go of the shit we deal with everyday life. You know what I mean? And I think it was that really spoke to my deepest, darkest secrets and demons that I could never really fully express. Like while I was dancing all the time to express myself, feel like I would express it and a little bit will be let go. But then like I would have to re-dance again. This sounds really weird. I don't know if you get me, but I feel like I'd have to practice again, like dance again to like deal with whatever was coming up for me again. And then it would sort of like temporary be almost like a band-aid. It would be like, a little bit band-aid there. And it would be healed. Well, I'd feel like it anyway for that little moment. Mm-hmm. And then I'd be like, but wait, it's still there. But dance hall was the thing that really made me go like, oh, wait, I'm actually really dealing with it. Like I feel like I'm dealing with it and it's actually moving it towards the space of it being healed.
Right.
In a more, I feel like we're always doing healing work. It's never going to end, right, till we go into the ground. But I just feel like in that time, dance hall was speaking to those things and healing it in a more, I guess, semi-permanent to permanent way than the other dances and music were, you know? And yeah, like I felt like my struggles and pain finally had a voice that spoke to it.
Yeah.
I know that might sound a bit negative because like dancehall also has its good sides, you know what I mean? As in like dancehall has both its good and its bad celebratory music and,
right,
you know, but let's be real, dancehall also comes from the struggle of the people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it's that energy that transcends in the music that I felt like connected with myself as well. Which then forced myself to dig deeper and to understand like, why am I connecting with this music that I don't even understand lyrically right now?
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. It feels like those little band-aid solutions that you're feeling from other kinds of music were just sort of surface level and dancehall was just like going right down to the root and just you were able to like resonate and vibrate on that same level.
It was just so raw. That's the word I've been looking for in this little babble moment that I had. It was so raw and just so authentic because obviously raw is authentic, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I was like, damn, like, wow, I'm really feeling this. There's no kind of, yes, it was produced and all this stuff, but like I just keep saying, going back to the energy, it's really the energy that just felt raw, real and authentic. Yeah.
Right. And with that authentic feeling, was it quite in contrast to the previous feeling you had with the kind of negative teacher where the music was telling you to do one thing and then you were being instructed to do something else? Did you find like more of a balance there with dancehall? Were you able to like bring out what you were feeling through it and was that accepted in the movement?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%. Because while dancehall dance has its vocabulary and steps and technique, it still really celebrates authentic expression and individuality and telling your story through that movement.
Okay.
That's at least how I've experienced it in the years that I've been dedicating my life to the practice, right?
So
I felt that. I felt that I could truly be me in the gentle sides, but more so at the time that I discovered in the more raw and angry sides of me. Like it wasn't like I had to sort of like quieten and be fake or put on a facade to that side of Nadia that was really hurting and that really had, that needed a voice and needed an outlet. And I felt like dancehall really spoke to that, you know, much like hip hop, really. I felt like hip hop was also that voice for me because I was always going back. I felt like before I discovered dancehall, hip hop was that go-to for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of hip hop, you mentioned that you saw, the first time you saw the class, it was hip hop brackets dance hall.
Yeah.
I feel like some 20 years later, we would never see that. Everyone just knows what a dance hall class is. What was it like being part of that kind of like, I don't know, almost, was it like the frontier of exploring that music style and dance style in Australia? Were there, you know, just like one or two teachers here and there doing it? And what was that feeling?
I'm going to speak on Brisbane specifically.
Yeah.
From my knowledge, 2008, when Amelia came to introduce that style, that is exactly when it was happening for Brisbane. Was 2008 was right. when that style really started to kind of be like be introduced. Sorry, into Brisbane. Yeah. You know, it was the beginning and early stages of dancehall dance being introduced into the scene, being introduced into the dance studios. So for that reason, studios couldn't really call the dance class dance hall straight off the bat because people didn't know what it was.
Mm.
And they had to call it hip hop. And then eventually with time and education and evolution, now it can be called dance hall. Yeah. Okay. But dance hall has existed in Australia. Dance hall dance has existed in Australia for much longer than that. And other cities like Sydney and Melbourne, even Perth for that matter, have actually had dancehall dance dancehall dance was introduced to these cities way before Brisbane.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. So we're in like 2008, 2010 sort of time. You're studying full time and immersing yourself in, I presume, as much dance as possible in the evenings. You find a really solid hook and taste into this dancehall movement and culture. How do you deepen your practice there?
Okay. So the timeline specifically when I was studying at university and taking classes at night was between 2005 and 2009.
Uh-huh.
2008 when I discovered dancehall.
Yeah.
And it was also around, I'd say six-ish months into, you know, really looking forward to every week taking class with Amelia.
Yeah.
When Nick Toth and the Make It Clap crew decided to have the second edition of Australian Dancehall Queen, and they had a national tour. So they had the 2007 one, third, and 2006 one, I believe. But 2008 was when they had one in Brisbane as well.
Right.
And that's when Amelia was like, I think you should enter the Brisbane Dancehall Queen competition. And I was like, what, really? Like, I've only been dancing this style for like 6 months. What do I know, you know? but she had my back since day one, and so many other people in that studio too. They were like, yeah, I think you got it. Like, let's go, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, with my very minimal knowledge at the time, Amelia and myself entered. So it was really great. My teacher entered too.
Wow.
We entered together and was crowned Brisbane Dancehall Queen. And that then gave me the opportunity to compete in the national finals in Sydney, I'd say about 3 to 4 months after that, for the Australian Dancehall Queen title, which I took out.
Wow.
And it was really because of that competition, in answering your question, that I went very deep into, well, as deep as I possibly can with the very minimal knowledge and access to knowledge that we could get.
Mm.
Because, of course, Amelia had her role in educating as much as she could with what she knew, but it was also on me as the student, if I really wanted to know more beyond the once a week dance classes, to also do my own homework, right? So it was really after winning the Brisbane Dancehall Queen competition, because to be entirely honest, I was like, what am I getting myself into? I'm just trusting my teacher. She said I could do it. All right, let me just go. It's a competition. I'm competitive. I'm going to enter myself, you know? But it was really through winning that title, and to be honest, feeling getting a lot of backlash for winning, actually. There was a few loud cats in the scene that felt like I didn't deserve the title. And there was a forum that was like all about it. And they were like, yeah, what is she doing representing Brisbane? Anyway, that kind of like really made me go, all right, fine. Okay, let me earn my stripes. Let me do my homework even more.
Mm.
And let me prepare so that I can do Brisbane and Queensland proud. So with the guidance of Nick Toth and DJ K-Note and all of them, I started to really research music videos, dance videos, read articles, and just ask as many questions as I can. At that time, mind you, YouTube was like very new at the time.
Yeah.
So even the most that I could get information-wise was dancehall music videos.
Right.
That was it. And those were also very minimal that was on YouTube, because obviously they would be probably showing those music videos on the screens in Jamaica, but not really fully uploading all of them to YouTube because YouTube is still very new at the time.
Right.
You know, so music videos was primary, and then a few dance videos came up. Like there was footage of international dancehall queen that was always being held in Montego Bay in Jamaica. And then Latonya Style, one of the key female dancehall dancers, she started releasing videos as well. And so she was someone that I was watching. But basically, I was doing as much as I possibly could with as much as the information that I could find that I had access to at the time, which I can't stress enough was extremely limited compared to today, where it's like, open your Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and you're like, all the information is there. Google it, you'll find it, you know? Yeah.
And so was that kind of the lack of information available then, was that something that inspired you to go further and seek more and actually like go out there and travel and find some of these?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I'd never really thought about it until this moment that you asked me, actually, if it was like due to lack of information that made me go and travel. But I would say that that definitely plays a role in it. I wouldn't say be the only reason why I traveled. I think that maybe the traveling thing has been in me since I was a kid, since I left, you know, Melbourne, moved to Malaysia, and then, you know, coming back to Australia. So I feel like, and then mum, I feel like maybe it also comes down to, you know, the fact that mum left South Africa at a young age too, and seeing that. And then my dad left Malaysia to go to Australia, left KL to come to Melbourne for a bit to study. So I think like knowing that as well, knowing that my parents were, I guess, travelers and going outside beyond their homelands to discover something in search of better, I guess, opportunities, right? Made me go, okay, wait, hold on. Maybe there's something beyond as well, wherever I am, to keep traveling and learning about other cultures and all that stuff. But I think that specifically in relation to reel it back in, because I tend to go off track. Specifically to dance hall, knowing that it came from Jamaica, knowing that Jamaica at the time for me felt so like a foreign land, you know, Australia, Jamaica in the maps, you look at it and you're like, wow, it's so far away, you know. But I knew that I had to go there one day to fully understand. And I don't even want to say fully, that's wrong. That's not the right word, because you never fully understand being a guest of the culture and not growing up there. You know what I mean? But
to deepen.
To deepen the understanding. And I suppose experience the things that I've read and seen and read in articles and books and seen in videos in real life.
Right. Okay. And what were those next phases of your sort of learning and immersion journey? I feel like you had and perhaps still have just like this insatiable appetite to learn and find these details and find the source in a way.
I think through dance hall, right? Dance hall has done so much for me. Like, besides everything I already told you about like healing and speaking to these parts of me that never had a voice before, it also made me go, wait, like, why do I feel that this sound feels familiar and almost ancestral, like I said to you before, right? And that made me really go, hold on, I never had the privilege growing up, unfortunately, due to family issues, to ever go and discover firsthand my South African roots, right? But it was really through dance hall that I did this really weird roundabout way to go and dig up my personal cultural roots, traditions. Through dance hall, found this way of backtracking to kind of go and dig up or learn more about my own cultural heritage from the South African side of things. And I think that was the very organic route that led me to always seek out this information, mainly being what I consider myself, a child of the world, you know, of course, mixed heritage. And, you know, my mom being a colored woman and knowing the history behind colored South Africans, yes, that is a term that is used. Mm. And knowing that there's history there with, you know, the indigenous Khoisan people, Bantu tribes, Europeans, you know, knowing that there's such a big, such a large, rich mix of cultures that exist within the colored communities of South Africa. And then knowing that that's part of my heritage, but also knowing that from my dad's side, my dad is Indonesian, Saudi Arabian. So I'm like, whoa, I have really rich bloodlines, you know, cultures from everywhere, you know. And so I think that just very organically knowing that, it's always made me go, hey, you know, if I'm practicing something that is an extension, an expression of a certain group of people, in this case, dancehall being an expression of Jamaican people, you know, I need to do the right thing and go and study that to the best of my ability. Where possible, where I have the means and accessibility to do that, I will always do that, you know. For example, I also do house, and I knowing that house was born in Chicago, New York as well, like Chicago and New York to be exact, sorry. You know, and then always wanting to go, I haven't been to Chicago yet, hopefully that's going to happen soon, but I always go to New York and experience the house parties there, you know. Of course, New York being the home and birthplace of hip-hop as well, you know. So I think that, like, this is probably opening up a whole other topic as well, but I think it comes down to also knowing that besides being a practitioner, I feel like I always just see that, like, I'm a student of the culture, forever learning, you know, whether it's my own cultures, whether it's another culture that's not necessarily mine or that I have in my bloodlines, if you say it like that. I just feel like life is constantly a learning process that, Till forever. That's a really bad English, but, you know, for forever, you know what I mean? And feel like when I took on the role to being a teacher and an educator, I think the importance of constantly searching for this knowledge and learning became a primary focus, because if I'm taking on this massive responsibility to be a leader, a facilitator, a vessel of passing on this knowledge, a teacher, an educator, all these words, right? That's a huge responsibility. There's people there that you're sharing information with for the first time that might have never seen, heard of this music, this dance, this culture, you know, whether it's dance or whatever culture it can be, whatever dance style it is, you know? It's important. It's important that we share to the best of our ability, you know, and we're never going to be perfect in sharing that information either. Like, sometimes there's going to be moments where you're going to think back at a time where you didn't have enough knowledge because maybe you didn't have access to it. And I can honestly say from my personal experience, there were times where I felt that way. I was like, oh, damn it. You know, that class back then, I said it was done like this, or I said it was this. But actually, now that I've learned even more, I realize I could have articulated it that much better, or I could have been more clear with it, or maybe not. You know what I mean, right? So it's always a learning thing. But I suppose it's always being clear with your intentions as to why you're practicing the dance, and why you decide to want to be somebody who shares and, shares the dance.
So we talked about the pursuit of dancehall styles, and you mentioned house briefly. Did your pursuit of your, one of the aspects of your own heritage, South Africa, did that, was that pursuit in line with connecting with Pansula and Amapiano?
100%.
Right.
Bit of a boogie there. I've always had an affinity or fascination for, like, styles that have footwork as well. And through house, house dance and house music, let's say house dance being a predominantly what most people from the outside look at and see as a footwork style. That led me to unveil. Wow. Okay. Unveil, dig up, discover, Consula.
Mm.
And it was through the parties in Melbourne that made me really discover the Mzansi house sound, or the South African house sound, or what a lot of people outside of South Africa called Afro house.
Okay. Yeah.
Sound.
Right.
And so
I love that framing that. Yeah. So good.
So for the lack for the sake of this podcast, if I'm going to refer to Mzansi house music, I'm going to be calling it house music from now on for everyone that needs to know that. So in 2012, I moved to Melbourne.
Right. Okay.
So sorry, I'm all over the place with all the information and timelines. But 2012, I decided to pack up my life and move to Melbourne. And it was in 2012 when I discovered house dance through Nish. And he was teaching house dance. There was also a couple of events around house music. Mm-hmm. Specifically, shout out DJ Chris NG, who did a lot of and still does a lot of house events like Afro Can and The Good Life. And there was a lot of it wasn't only strictly house music, but it was also soul, you know, like soul singers, and there was a bit of UKG mixed in there as well, which was really vibes.
Yeah.
But it was really through my time in Melbourne in 2012 that made me go now on a more on a secondary discovery of new dance style for me and new dance, new kind of music for myself, you know. And through that, because I always had an affinity for footwork and an interest for that, I started digging things up more. And through discovering Mzansi house music, South African house music outside of South Africa, we call it house music, just Afro house, sorry. I started to discover Pansula, you know. And Pansula is a dance style and a culture, much like dancehall, that was born out of the townships. And of course, there's so much more to say about that, but it is, once again, an expression of the people. And it is very footwork heavy as well. And so I felt that there was a relationship there. And in the last couple of years, through reading a couple of books on the history of dance and culture, specifically within the colored South African community, I discovered that there is another dance style that I could be wrong. I need to still do more my research on this, but I feel like it could be connected somehow. There's a style called Reels, R-I-E-L-S. Once again, I could be wrong in pronouncing it.
Yeah.
But it's so footwork heavy, and it's a very, 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 very small community. And, so it's just a constant learning process of, like, you know, researching and, discovering the dances that come from my homelands, whether it's South Africa or Malaysia. Yeah.
One of the biggest movements in dance styles that we might have seen in the last year is, in, I guess, both in music and dance style, has been Amapiano coming to the fore. What has been your involvement like that, and what's it like to see a culture from your homelands being so prominent around the world?
Piano. Piano. Okay. I have a great story with that one. In 2019, just before a whole year and a bit before COVID hit, I went back to South Africa again, specifically Joburg, and I was spending time. I generally go back to Joburg to spend time with my crew via Vandal Pansulas. And at the time, that's when a piano was starting to really take over South Africa specifically. So right. Amapiano has been around for a while before then already. But it was around that time that I went that they started to tell me like, yo, Nadia, like, you know, there's this new sound, you know, Amapiano's taken over South Africa, you know, all this kind of stuff. You got to get on it. House music, it's not a thing anymore. And I was like, how dare you? How dare you say house music is not a thing anymore? It would always be a thing, you know? So because for me, even though... I heard Amapiano as a different sound. I also recognized its house electronic relationship to the umbrella term of house music. It still fell into that, even though it was a slower BPM and tempo and everything. But I remember at the time when I heard it in 2019, when I was spending time with them, I was like, yo, this sound, it's deep and it's dark and the bass beat is juicy and it's like it really kind of, and especially on the big, it has to be on the big sound system. It cannot be on small speakers. Right. Amapiano can never be fully appreciated if it's on small speakers. I have to stress that because I remember when I heard it on the big speakers, I was just like, boom, boom. And I was like, wait, no, this is strong, you know? And I really enjoyed my time at that time back in South Africa at the time. And that was when I really started to kind of like get into Amapiano, right? That was before COVID.
Yeah.
And that was before the rest of the world caught on to the hype, if I say it like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Of Amapiano. So fast forward now, COVID's hit. Everyone's now in lockdown and I guess everyone's seeking refuge in all these different social media platforms. People are mixing live and being able to, I guess, reach audiences like they've never been able to reach before,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so one of my fondest memories was when Cubs That Is Small and DJ Maparisa were like clockwork, always live. I don't know where they got the creativity from. I mean, maybe obviously it's through the struggle of being in a lockdown or whatever it is, you know what I mean? Like I think some of the greatest creative projects and ideas that were born out of these moments. And as we know, the greatest art forms and styles, hip hop, dance hall, pansula, all came out of struggle, right? All came out of adversity. So yeah, they were always there with their live mixing, you know, and I think it was DJs and producers like them that really, this is my opinion.
Yeah,
I could be wrong because it's how I experienced it, but I really feel like how Amapiano really kind of like started to touch people that I couldn't touch before. Because of course, when the world was open, people weren't really bothered to go online and go like, let me watch a mixing session, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But now everyone's locked inside, what can I do? And I think that's how they discovered more and more. And then of course, people dancing indoors and dance to the music. And so social media platform being that primary focus and outlet for literally the whole world during this period of time, I feel like really helped push Amapiano go beyond its borders and now is what I feel like one of the sounds that it's taken over the world, you know, like it's wild. And I'm like so proud. I'm not even an Amapiano producer or DJ. I mean, well, you know, emerging DJ.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, it's really great to see that the sound has been able to break through because in my opinion, once again, my personal experience here, because a lot of the music that comes out of South Africa is sung in so many different languages. We have 11 official languages and they're generally sung in Zulu, Xhosa, and all the other languages. And I think that for that reason, it can't really connect to the wider audience outside.
Right.
It's very specific, right?
Yeah.
And even though Amapiano is sung in a lot of those languages, it's the beat. I feel like it's the beat that really captures people. And that's the thing that resonates throughout. Like when people kind of go like, I don't understand what these people are saying, but damn, I'm really feeling this beat right now. You know what I mean? And I feel like maybe once again, going back to what I was saying about this thing about being locked down and all this kind of things, I feel like that really, like, it's like, I feel like people kind of listened more do you know what I mean? Like, they, I feel like they listened more, like they paid more attention maybe.
Yeah.
Because like South Africa's been producing, don't mind me, I'm going to get a bit patriotic here, but South Africa's been producing like some great music for decades, yeah. like through all the genres. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Gom
yeah.
was one of them, you know, even though it's a smaller genre now, of course, house, you know. Uh-huh. But like I said, I just think that this, these sounds unfortunately didn't really break through, whereas Amapiano did. And I think it did because of the context that it broke through on as well.
Mm,
yeah.
Right. But also the distinct movement and the way that that like represents a culture. I remember like the first few like Amapiano video clips I saw. It's like these people are like talking a certain language with their bodies and I don't know any of it, but it is amazing to watch. Like,
yeah.
I feel like that is also like a big fact, like not just, okay, maybe we're not understanding the words and but we're feeling the music, but also we're in lockdown, so we're seeing some visual to it. And I imagine even in the DJ sets, the DJs are also speaking that language. And I feel like there's like a sharpness to it. Like some of the movements are really like, I don't have enough vocal, like kind of vocabulary, dance vocabulary to describe it. But the movement is so distinct and the people are all on the same page about it, that I found that element really striking. And I imagine that might be some part of what like kind of draws people to it.
Yeah. I think that this is, I keep making this disclaimer as saying that this is my opinion, because obviously it's my opinion and it's my experience, right?
Yeah.
And also from the years of studying and practicing multiple different styles, I feel like Amapiano has caught on and become so widespread because it's accessible. What I mean by that is with the slowed down tempo, people can pick up the movements a lot easier,
okay.
right? And people that not necessarily are fully blown trained dancers,
right.
okay? Because Amapiano is basically a evolution, or it is a combination that takes inspiration from multiple different street styles that had already existed in South Africa
right.
before its time, right?
Right.
Pansula is namely one of them. Spujwa as well.
Mm.
Benga as well, you know? These are moves that had like a strong presence in different provinces around South Africa,
right.
different communities. And I think that Amapiano movement is literally lending from all of these movements. And then also through that, new movement is being created at the same time.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like music, right? Like, you know, when how new genres pop up because of a DJ accidentally bumping up the tempo,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with this movement, I feel. You know, Pansula is very fast. When you watch it, you're like, oh, okay, wait, I'm going to just sit down and watch this
right.
rather than let me try it. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
So, whereas when you watch Amapiano, you're like, oh, actually, it's a tempo that I can kind of follow, you know? So, yeah, a lot of the movement for me, having practiced Pansula first, I feel like I can see a lot of the Pansula influences in Amapiano, you know?
Right.
And like they say in the country, Amapiano is a lifestyle, you know? Another famous phrase that we like to say is the aim is not to sweat, because, you know, you just want to be like grooving nicely and still looking fine and fly and, you know, but still doing the grooves, but not going too hard. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
yeah. And there's multiple subgenres and sounds within Amapiano as well. You
yeah.
know, not every single Amapiano, if I want to say subgenre or sound of Amapiano is danced on, you know what I mean? Like a lot of the sounds that we hear on TikTok and Instagram or social media in general,
yeah.
it's like usually the commercial beats or what we say quantum sound, like the really heavy ones that have the log drums, you know?
Okay.
That's really attractive because it's like people hear it and they go like, oh, I want to like hit all those beats, you know what I mean? But you've also got the super chill sounds of Amapiano, which is usually, you know, you experience them in like more, chilled out family community gatherings, so to speak, and people are just more like a braai, like a barbecue period, like time, sorry, barbecue period. Uh-huh. Usually at a braai is when these kinds of more relaxed, chilled out tunes are being heard and people are like more of a, yeah.
Right. So going back in early 2019, that South African trip, catching early waves of, perhaps not early waves, but waves of saturation of Amapiano going around the country. Are you already teaching dance at this stage, but still going and pursuing your learning? And there's like a loop between those, like the student teacher hats are kind of worn in some sort of
absolutely
cycle.
Yeah. I've started teaching dance in 2010.
Right.
And I started teaching dance hall.
Yeah.
Amongst other styles, hip hop, a bit of jazz here and there, you know, because at the time that's when I was like doing all those styles still.
Yeah.
And then eventually I started to specialize and focus mainly on dance hall. And then present day, I do a bit of house, a bit of Afro fusion styles, and more recently, Amapiano. But yeah, I think that like if I didn't wear the student hat often and go and fill my cup, like my mom likes to say, and get more information and knowledge and feed into my own personal practice, and never-ending book of information, I don't think that I would enjoy teaching as much.
Right.
You know? Because I think, it's my opinion, once again, it's important that dance teachers are also being students. You know, you because where is your inspiration, or who is your mentor? Like, our mentors have mentors, and they have mentors. You know, we always have mentors.
That's right. That's
you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so it's like, there's this common misconception or misunderstanding that as soon as you step into this role as being a teacher, you're automatically a leader. And yes, you are, but it doesn't mean because you're a leader that you stop being a student. You know what I mean? In fact, I think like when I can be, let's just say, what I enjoy the most is when I'm being booked at festivals or events as a teacher. And the part that I probably look forward to the most, maybe even more than my own classes, is the fact that I get to just jump into the next person's class. Like, that's so great. Like, to be able to be like, thank you so much for everyone for coming to my class, my workshop. I hope you've learned something. And let me go and take someone else's class now. I really enjoy being a student. Yeah. Yep.
Right. I feel like I noticed that when some of your Paradoxal crew were visiting, and there was that kind of environment where you were able to teach some classes and jump into others. You are someone who's not only a child of the world, person of the world, but it often just at times just feels like, where is Nadia in the world? She is in some other country. Can you tell me about this Parisian chapter and that connection to
yes shout out Paradoxal. Yes, so I moved to Paris in early 2017.
Yeah.
And it was on a one-way ticket. I literally sold all my belongings, including this old 1992 Toyota Corolla, and with two suitcases of everything that I ever owned and whatever money I could gather from selling all those belongings, I moved to Paris. And it was because it was inspired by the fact that in 2015, I did a 7-month dance pilgrimage. I called it dance pilgrimage because it was 7 months, and I went to all the hubs or the homelands of the dance styles that I specialize in or that I practice.
Right.
And that was a very important chapter in my life. And because what I needed from that was, besides, okay, understanding it firsthand through being immersed in the culture and the settings and the community and exchanging and networking, it was also understanding my place in the wider community as a contributor, as a student, as a teacher, as a creator, you know what I mean? It was super important to understand my place and to also connect with those who came before me, who have laid this foundation that I can continue carrying forward in my own homelands and on my in my journey. So it was through that experience that I said, okay, wait, I think there are more opportunities overseas that I can, what's the word? There's more opportunities overseas for me to expand on my career, okay, as a dancer, as a movement artist, and across basically just being a creative overall. My number one place to move to actually still is New York City. Mm. I really wanted to move there, but if anyone knows what it's like to get an artist visa, to live and work as an artist in the US, it's super expensive. Mm. So I happened to be just like searching for visas in France. And that's how I discovered that there's actually an artist, or what they call a cultural artist visa in France. And I was like, let me check this out. Let me read a little bit more about it. Lo and behold, it was such an affordable price and at the time a relatively easy process. So I said, okay. Came back to Australia at the end of 2015 in December. And 2016, I said, all right, here's the goal, Nadia. We're not going to be here for more than 12 months. By the end of this year, you're going to be on a plane to somewhere. Where that somewhere is, we'll figure it out. But for now, let's just put our head down and work towards that goal. Mm. So it was around the middle of the year that I was like, right, I think it's going to be Paris. It's more realistic, you know, on a financial level. Also, because in 2015, I connected with a lot of important leaders in the French dance community around dance hall, around house, around hip hop. And these people really kind of, they saw something in me. They really believed in me. They felt like the way I danced, what I brought, the energy that came, the stories that came with my movement was something that they really connected with and wanted to push and have in their scene. So that was a really, really powerful and encouraging fuel for me to go, all right, 2016, let's go. So worked, saved all this money and moved to Paris 2017. And so now I'm in Paris, and I've reconnected with Babson, my late mentor. He's no longer with us, rest in peace, from the Wanted Posse and Serial Steppers crew. And when I met him in 2015, sorry, a lie. Yeah, 2014, 2015. Oh my God. Timeline. Mm. I believe it was 2015. Yes, at Big Up Camp. And then again, when I went back to Paris, because I kind of went back and forth around France and Europe and everything like that. So I first met him, went away on my thing, and then came back a couple of weeks, months later to come back to Paris. And that's when he was like, hey, what are you doing? Are you staying in Paris? What's your deal? Etc. I have a crew by the name of Paradoxal, a crew of girls who all specialize in house, but they also have their individual specialties like popping, locking, break, hip hop, dance hall, traditional African movement. And I was like, my eyes lit up, because I remember seeing a video of them after my first trip, I believe it was, it popped up on my timeline in Facebook. And I was like, oh my God, who are these girls? Wow, what a dream it would be to be a part of like an all-female, all-style dance crew, but specifically house too, because at the time I was getting really, really into house, alongside my dance hall, of course. And anyway, fast forward, 2017, reconnected with Babson or Baba. And I was like, I'm in Paris now. Like, you know, and he's like, okay, great. Like, why don't you come to some of our training sessions, meet the girls. Let's see how the girls take to you and see if you also feel like you fit in with the crew and all this kind of stuff. And so we went through all these processes. I sat in with some rehearsals as well. And then slowly but surely picked up and learned some of their bits and pieces of the shows that they were doing at the time, and that was Fighting Spirit. And I remember seeing one of their shows in a place called Main d'Oeuvre, and they performed fighting spirit. And it was that night that Baba said to me, "Hey, I'd like to officially welcome you as a member of Paradoxal." And that was also the official night that Valentina, another girl that was training with them before me, who came from Italy, was also initiated and invited into the crew. Yeah.
And recently there was the ladies' takeover back at Mad Dance House, a mixture of workshops and then a showcase performance where we were working together. I was helping shoot a video for the event where you had a small teaser performance of
amazing teaser, by the way,
of Queen's Blood, the show, right? With just four of the what would otherwise be how many?
Oh, there's we have 16 official members.
Okay, right.
But we've performed Queen Blood with as little as six up to as many as nine of us.
Right. Yeah. So I got to have a little taste of that teaser, and through shooting the video as well, like I'm kind of getting shots of the performers and yourself backstage, and there's like massage guns and rolling pins and all this sort of thing. And then I'm sort of there with you at that moment where you're like stretching out backstage about to get announced. And my nearest reference point for that is almost like these like elite athletes, like Olympics level athletes that are about to like hit the 100-meter sprint and they're about to go. And it's just this phenomenal energy and kind of level of artistry involved in kind of maintaining that energy and that sort of frenetic pace of the footwork and the house moves, even though it was just four out of what would be up to 16 performers. What was it like for you to bring that little slice of Paris to Brizzy?
It was so good. It really... I haven't had the opportunity to have a full circle moment yet because the full crew hasn't come out to Australia yet.
Yeah.
But it definitely was a taster of what it could be like having my girls out here. Mm. And I would like to just touch on the little moment that you mentioned, how you felt like it was like this feeling of like an Olympic, you know, like getting warmed up for that.
Yeah.
And that's because the show Queen Blood, even though we only did an extract of it, is an extremely physical show.
Right.
You know, it goes for 1 hour and 10 minutes.
Okay.
The genius that Baba is, the show doesn't have wings when it's performed on stage. Is wings the right word?
All the performers are there invisible the entire time.
We are visible the entire time.
Wow.
Even though there's moments where we step off the stage, and generally the stage is white.
Yeah.
We step off the stage, but we're still in character.
Mm.
And the fact that most of the show is heavily house dance based, house dance is very fast paced, and it's very very much of a cardio workout. You know, we do have breather moments, but it is a very physical show. So that's probably why you got that impression, because after all the years of touring it, specifically the girls, because we launched the show in 2019 in March, and then we managed to kind of get momentum throughout 2019, but it was really in 2020 when COVID hit that things kind of slowed down a little bit, but then picked up immensely. But by that point, I was back in Australia. So even though the show has been touring for all those years. But anyway, bringing it back to Ladies Takeover Festival, I was very, very lucky for two of our official Paradoxal members to be in Australia being booked for a whole other different festival. And then two other friends that I've known from the community as well in Paris come through being booked for the same show that those two girls were booked on. Audrey and Nadia were booked on that. And then Moen and Tina as well, right? Mm. And anyway, so I was like, what a great opportunity. Australia is not right next door to France. Like, let's try and figure out how I can bring these girls to Brisbane, because I really would love the community to have the opportunity to learn and exchange with all these phenomenal dancers, in my opinion, you know, across the different styles. And so going back to the showcase night where we performed Queen Blood, it was really emotional for me, I must admit, you know, because it is still my dream to have Queen Blood tour Australia. Not because of the fact that I was in the show, a part of the original cast, or part of the fact that we helped shape and build and choreograph the show with Babson. But because of everything that it stands for, you know, everything that we've been through as a crew, I feel like now Queen Blood has such an emotional, deep story and connection to us personally. But I think that we're able to convey that to the audience. And I feel like time and time again, whenever it's performed, the audience really do feel the depth of the show, you know, of us individually through our personal journeys, emotionally and energetically. But I also think that because it has brought us so much closer, and also because all of us have this, our individual specialities and styles that we practice, that too is such, from an artistic and creative perspective, so inspiring to see, you know, because it's like, wow, like, okay, there's all these women from multiple different cultural backgrounds, but also they have this one man that has kind of like been instrumental in mentoring, choreographing, creating this vision that is Queen Blood. And yes, they brought together Bauhaus dance, but here's also their individual styles, and here's also their individual stories, and here's their story together. There's just so many layers to it, you know what I mean? And then on top of that, of course, the fact that we're all females too, you know, and telling that story through the female lens and the different nuances of being a woman today. You know, and so I think that it really does speak to a lot of people, if not all people worldwide. You know, yeah.
You are someone who managed to sort of seemingly maintain a presence in like some half a dozen countries, and you wear many, many hats, many more than we could possibly explore in one sitting. But we haven't talked too much apart from this Paradox Old Chat about your performer hat. And there's one recent moment that I wanted to talk about in particular, which was there's been an emerging festival here, Promised Land, coming up in the last couple of years. And there was something of quite a profound full circle moment that happened to you connected with that festival. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I can. Coffee come in like a rupture and everybody get capture. Yo, I am such a fan. I'm such a fan. Are we talking about my dancer hat or my rap hat? I don't know right now. I don't know. Yes. Oh my God. Coffee. I had the incredible opportunity to dance for Coffee, one of my favorite artists, and one of the artists that I have been wanting to actually dance for since I discovered her when she released her EP in 2000 and, well, she released her EP in 2018, but it was in 2019 when I really kind of got into her, early 2019. And I kept on manifesting that. And like, I was like, yes, I'm going to dance for Coffee one day, and started creating all these visuals to her music, trying to get the community behind me to tag her so she would discover me, still back in those days. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, I still believe in that, you know, the social media game, you know. It didn't work out for me that time because obviously divine timing. But yeah, like, was communicating with the Promised Land team to perform at Promised Land at the festival. That didn't work out. But sure enough, a week after that fell through, the choreographer for Coffee, Jazz, shout out Jazz, she got in touch with me via Instagram on my DMs and was like, yo, like, we're coming out to Australia to perform with a major reggae artist. Doesn't mention who it is. Would like for you to be on board and to also assist with the casting. And like the casting call specifically, and helping maybe get arrange some like rehearsal space and this kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
And
you're becoming the port of call.
Yeah. And that was really great for me because I also just in 2000 and it was early, no, it was late 2022 when I decided to really put my head down and launch my emerging events production arm,
yeah.
Infuse Events. And so that was a really great time for Infuse Events as well to kind of like take on that opportunity of, you know, working with Jazz and Coffee's management in assisting with rehearsal space and all of that stuff. So she was like, yep, great. I want you to be on the team. And for the first 2 weeks of us conversing, as the entertainment world works, it's usually up until you sign the contract. Sometimes it's even when you're barely getting on the plane that things can like actually fall through. So because I'm so used to that, I was just like, yeah, I'm not really going to hold my breath. I'm not going to get too excited. Like, let's just see how this unfolds, you know. 1 week passes, 2 week passes, 2 weeks pass. Oh, my God. And eventually I muster up the courage to be like, by the way, who is this major reggae artist? You still haven't told me who it is. And what exactly are the dates? And she told me the dates. And I was like, wait, that is suspiciously lining up with Promised Land. So I was like, it can't be. Can it be? Oh my God. I was just like,
because out of that whole lineup of the festival, your dream would be
Coffee.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there were other artists too.
Yeah.
Coffee at the time, I must admit, wasn't the artist that I was pitching for, purely because after watching her live shows in Germany, I got the impression and understanding that as she's a mainly reggae artist and does a couple of dancehall tracks, and I mean she has a fair few now in a catalog of music,
right,
but generally her shows are more live music, well not live music, her shows are more reggae based music, mm-hmm. And so even though we can dance to that, I felt like I didn't see any dancers dance to her music, right, but I didn't know that all these years later that actually Jazz, having being her current choreographer, that she has had dances prior to Promised Land. So it was only through, I only discovered that through obviously connecting with Jazz and finding out about the previous shows they had done.
Okay.
So that's why Coffee for me at the time wasn't on my radar, but she was definitely on my radar to go see anyway,
right?
But anyway, so asking her, yeah, who's it, da-da? And she goes, okay, you know how the industry is, but as we've been communicating and I know that you're, you know, you understand how the industry works, this stays confidential, but it's Coffee. And I was like, literally going like, as in the Coffee, like this cannot be real. And I was just, oh, like usually when I get excited about these things, I do a little like, kind of thing moment. I have a little kind of moment and then I go and I just kind of jump up and down and everything, and then I go, okay, wait, come back to earth. It's not confirmed, don't get too excited.
Yeah,
let's breathe and let's just go like, all right, manifest that it's really going to go all the way through the end, you know what I mean? And anyway,
yeah, because you've danced for some big names before, but this one was for you.
Yeah this one, the way it came in, that is why I say divine timing. That's why I believe so deeply in the universe and being aligned with your purpose and truly believing in what you're here on this earth to do. You know, like I truly feel that way. I truly feel that my purpose is expressing my story, sharing my story through movement, through art, and then giving, and through doing that, through being so passionate about that, it gives the people around me permission to also explore what their passion is, you know, to also do what they love to do and really maybe discover what that is for them, you know, in this lifetime,
yeah.
You know? And so, because just the way that happened was just way too much like a dream, you know? Promised Land organizers fell through a week later. You know, I've met Jazz in a class once before when we were in New York, but it's not like we stay connected that way. You know what I mean? We didn't go out and eat together when I was in New York. We didn't chill like that. It was in a class room that I saw that she was there.
Right.
And and then she hit me up. But I also want to give a shout out to King Kayak, my bro, who I brought out around the same time that Coffee was here. It was actually also King Kayak who mentioned to Jazz, I got my girl, my sis in Australia. like you got to hit her up. If you're going to look, if you're looking for dancers for coffee, it has to be Nadia in Brisbane. Like, you know, so also thanks to him. Yeah.
Well, I think, I feel like after diving into these aspects of your story that I might wake up tomorrow, like feeling like I've got some jet lag. But I would like to thank you so much for coming on Creator Tales today.
Thank you so much for having me. Pup, 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 pup.